It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up in a few minutes, should Wisconsin have toll roads? Could be easier to put into practice under a change that the Obama administration is asking for. We'll hear what's going to change, and we'll get your thoughts as well.
First, the state's largest wildfire in 33 years happened 1 year ago today. A final DNR report reveals a fast, cool response and an investigation that gives an inside look at the major players in the disaster. Mike Simonson reports.
The Garin Road fire last May 14th torched 7,500 acres of mostly pine forest and destroyed more than 100 buildings, including 22 homes in Douglas and Bayfield counties. 350 structures were threatened but saved. It took 2 days to get the flames under control. The fire danger was high that day with dry conditions before the spring green-up.
Douglas County 911, what's the emergency?
There's a forest fire in Douglas County.
Records and audio obtained by a Wisconsin Public Radio open records request told of a fire that was quickly out of control.
It's taken off fast.
Yep, I understand. Attention, Gordon Fire Department,
DNR,
response to the German Road.
Ray Dewar Logging Company was billed $600,000 by the DNR for negligence after their equipment sparked the blaze. This is from a DNR interview of equipment operator Stephen Hankey the day after the fire started at the place where it started.
Within seconds. Because I seen it starting to go where it started right there. I run over, tried putting out my extinguisher. Well, by the time I got over there and the wind picked up, the flames were too big that I could do anything with it. As soon as those flames got big and I moved my machine as fast as it was, I didn't want my machine to burn. Did the best I could with what I had, and once it got out of hand, I took off.
Douglas County 911.
Hi, DNR dispatch.
Hey there.
We are responding.
Okay.
And we have 2 rangers and 4 heavy units, and we will have a plane overhead at some point.
Oh, you guys rock.
But the tinder conditions and a sudden 90-degree wind shift forced the DNR to move command headquarters and the evacuation center. So the report says on-scene coordinators didn't plan for a worst-case scenario of the wind change. DNR Forest Protection Director Trent Marty says overall, communication between the 40 different responding agencies was strong.
It just wasn't a very good heads-up for firefighters coming there until they got actually to the fire that there was going to be a predicted wind shift. The wind shift was communicated well in the fire and handled well from a safety standpoint.
The DNR can order logging companies to halt operations on state land when fire conditions are very high. The Garin Road fire was on private land, and Marty says even if it was on state land, weather conditions fell short of that criteria.
No, I don't think the conditions were extreme and stuff in that regards. At any time, they never met that criteria and stuff, and we would have known those type of conditions were going to occur. The humidity was lower than predicted. The wind speeds were higher than predicted. There was just a lot of different factors that occurred.
On-site DNR investigator Gary Bebo did try to comfort owner Ray Dewar and logger Don Rodman.
There was nothing that was done intentionally. You've made every attempt to put it out, so I really do appreciate that.
Well, everybody here feels like
can't even sleep.
No fines were levied or criminal charges filed in the case. Marty says the teamwork was about as good as he'd ever seen, and he says there were plenty of heroes that day. This is evacuated resident June Thielen of Highland. Her hero was DNR warden Lance Burns.
I went to the door, and a man was there that said, "Evacuate fire, June." He even used my name, and all I saw was smoke, and I was just petrified. He said, "We have less than 5 minutes." I was so scared. I've got to find my angel. A voice behind me said, "I was there, June, it was me." And I turned around and I go, "Lance." I just hugged him. That hug went all the way to Scott Walker's office, our governor.
Burns was given the life-saving award from Walker a week later. He says there were a lot of responders who should not be forgotten.
There was a whole herd of other people and everybody pitched in.
Mike Simonson, Wisconsin Public Radio in Superior.
This is Central Time. Coming up, a report by the New York Fed shows that household debt has increased for the third straight quarter. Is this good or bad news for households and the economy as a whole?
First, the White House may be paving the way toward more toll roads in the United States and here in Wisconsin. The administration has a proposal before Congress that would allow states to turn existing interstate highways into tollways.
The tolls would be aimed at meeting highway repair costs, and the proposal comes amidst a shortfall in federal transportation funding. Robert Poole joins us now. He's director of transportation policy at the Reason Foundation, and he's written reports on the possibility of toll roads in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Rob. Glad to be here.
Well, first of all, what exactly is the Obama administration looking to change?
What they're looking to change is to eliminate a federal ban on tolling existing interstates that are not tolled, but for the specific purpose of reconstructing and modernizing them. It would not be to make it a general transportation funding source.
And do you expect a lot of states to get on board with this if the change becomes a reality?
Last time it was proposed, about a half a dozen states were actively supporting it, including Florida and Texas. I think it depends a lot on what else happens in Congress. If Congress doesn't come up with a significant amount of highway money in the reauthorization this fall, and there's a huge hole in the budget for that, then I think if they do pass the permission for states to look at this, I think a number of states will be interested in it because they know they have a big problem. The interstates are their most important highways, and properly maintaining them and rebuilding them as they start to wear out is going to be a big-ticket item.
I want to throw this out to listeners to join in. Do you think Wisconsin, if this becomes reality, should consider toll roads, making some of our current freeways tollways? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Robert, you've studied our transportation system here in Wisconsin. What's the case for a state like ours to consider toll roads in particular?
Well, you have an aging interstate system. A few of them were built more closer to now, but most of them were built in the original program that started in 1956. And most highways, even if they're well-maintained, have a pavement life of about 50 years. So that means that over the next decade or two, a lot of your interstates are going to be really needing to be rebuilt in order that they not deteriorate and really start falling apart. And that is going to cost a lot of money. I mean, the most recent study that we did, a nationwide study looking at it state by state, was that it's going to cost $6 to $7 billion to rebuild all the interstates in Wisconsin. Now, I know that one has recently been reconstructed from the state line up to Milwaukee, but that's the only part, as far as I know, that has actually had a reconstruction. The rest are going to need it over the next decade or two. And it's going to be the biggest highway expense probably in the state's history, given what things cost today.
And so, Robert, even with that argument, the cost that is looming, you mentioned the words toll roads to a lot of people who live in Wisconsin, and you're not going to get a great response.
No,
people just have this visceral reaction.
And how nice it is to get out of Illinois and get into Wisconsin.
Right.
But the question is, what, the alternative would be a very large fuel tax increase, gas tax and diesel tax in Wisconsin, unless there's some kind of manna from heaven coming from Washington, which looks increasingly unlikely in the federal government's budget condition. So it's a question of which way do you want to pay to do something that just about everybody, certainly your state DOT, believes will be necessary.
And we've seen some reaction already from parts of the trucking industry, businesses that rely on trucking, in part
right.
Concerned that, hey, this is going to drive up costs for them and, in turn, consumers who rely on the products they're carrying. Isn't that a real concern?
It is definitely a concern, and I just recently re-released a new Reason Foundation study called Value-Added Tolling, A Better Deal for America's Highway Users, that's on the Reason.org website. And we said, look, let's take seriously those concerns about users. This should not be a losing proposition for highway users. So we said, look, use the tolling, first of all, only for reconstruction when reconstruction is needed, or for widening if an interstate needs to be widened, and then only charge enough to cover the cost of that construction or reconstruction and proper maintenance. Don't make it tolls any higher than they really need to be to just do that job, and only start tolling after the major improvements are completed. So you're not paying while you have to sit through construction. You're only paying for something better than when it actually gets built. And finally, give rebates for the existing gas taxes that people would be implicitly paying. You don't want them paying tolls and fuel taxes on the same stretch of improved highway. So it's very easy with today's electronic tolling, like the iPass down in Illinois. You know who each customer is, you know how many miles they drove, and you know what the fuel economy of their vehicle is. So both trucks and cars could get a rebate done electronically, which could be, for example, deducted from their annual vehicle registration fee. So there's definitely ways to do this that would not be that painful to highway users.
We're talking about the possibility of toll roads here in Wisconsin with Robert Poole. He studies these issues with the Reason Foundation. The Obama administration has asked Congress to loosen up restrictions on states, allowing them to turn existing freeways into toll roads to meet maintenance costs.
And we want to know what you think about this idea. Would you want to meet expenses for infrastructure, the highways in Wisconsin, by installing toll roads here in Wisconsin? Why or why not? 800-642-1234 is our number. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email talk@wpr.org. We continue our conversation about toll roads now and whether Wisconsin needs them after the Obama administration asked Congress to allow states to turn existing highways into tollways. And our guest Robert Poole with the Reason Foundation makes the case that lots of Wisconsin roads need replacing, need upgrading, and this is one way to pay for it.
You can join in. What do you think about the idea of toll roads in Wisconsin? Like it? You don't? Well, if not toll roads, how do you pay for highway maintenance? Call 800-642-1234 or head over to the Central Time Facebook page and post your thoughts there.
We'll go to our phones now. We've got Bill on the line from New Berlin. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
What do you think?
Well, I say absolutely no to toll roads, and I'll tell you why. First of all, once the roads are paid for, the tolls will continue just like they did in Chicago, way beyond their need. It just becomes another tax, just like when they increased my water bill from $20 a month to $60 a month to pay for the new sewer. It was supposed to go away after the sewer was paid for, but it never did.
Okay, got it, Bill. And Bill's saying that once those tolls are there, they're there forever, even when the roads are paid for. What do you think about that, Robert?
I think that is the way it actually ought to be. We ought to be replacing per-gallon fuel taxes with per-mile tolls as the permanent replacement funding source, not simply as a temporary thing for a one-time set of construction. Because roads, highways always need maintenance. I mean, the toll might be able to be lower in the future once the cost of reconstruction is paid for, if you do that in less than 50 years until it needs reconstruction again. But the whole transportation community in America, people who study this professionally, believe that the gas tax is on a long decline, and because of fuel economy standards and so forth, you know, the miles per gallon required by a new car will be 54.5 miles a gallon by 2025. That's going to devastate the highway trust fund because it means you can go twice as far in a gallon of gas, and you're still wearing and tearing the road just as much, but you're only producing half as much revenue. So we really need to start thinking about how to replace the gas tax with something more sustainable.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Dennis with us in Oshkosh. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I do drive truck for a living in northeast Wisconsin, and this winter was especially tough on all the roads, the deep frost, and a lot of these roads need repair, rebuilding instead of just patching potholes. And so I would be all for a toll.
Dennis, thanks for the call. Somebody who uses the road a lot thinks it's worth the tolls to fix them up, Robert.
I think that's very encouraging, and I hope he speaks to his fellow truck drivers on that subject, because the trucking industry right now is very adamantly opposing and loudly opposing the administration's proposal.
Robert, is there any evidence or data out there, I should say, about how tolls affect crashes, accidents?
Yeah, there is data, actually, that shows that compared to a regular interstate highway, a tolled interstate is somewhat safer. Not a huge amount, but somewhat safer. And no one really knows why, but that's what the data do show. They're also tolled interstates are in generally a better condition than non-tolled ones, probably because they don't have to fight in the legislature every year for maintenance money.
And before we go back to our callers, I wanted to ask about the state of the art in toll road technology. It seems like when I drive in other states, it's come a long way from everybody lines up to throw money into a basket.
Absolutely. Cash toll collection is on a fast track to oblivion. States, Texas, Florida, Colorado, many of the eastern states as well are getting rid of cash tolling altogether and going with the EasyPass or iPass type of electronic system, supplemented by license plate imaging. If you only use the toll roads a little and you don't want to bother having a transponder, they can video your license plate and create a bill that way.
Okay, let's go back to our phones now. Mike joins us from Barron. Hey, Mike.
Hi. You know, I'm dead set against tolls, and the principal reason is that tolls are going to be taking a substantial amount of their money from cars, motorcycles, things of that nature, whereas it's well documented. It was documented in Wisconsin's Tommy Thompson's report on, in, I think it was called the 2020 plan, that heavy trucks and commercial traffic do better than 80% of all the damage on the highways and byways and roads and streets. And going to a toll system, which is going to put a lot more of that toll gathering into light cars and vehicles that basically are not the cause of most of the damage on the highways.
Gotcha, Mike. What about that, Robert? Should the burden be on trucking companies?
Yeah, he's absolutely right that heavy trucks do most of the damage to pavement. And so most toll roads in the United States charge 3 or 4 times as much per mile for trucks as they, for heavy trucks as they do for cars. And in the big study that I authored last year, we assumed a 4 times higher rate for trucks than for cars. And I think that would be the way it would end up being. The state DOTs all know this and definitely want to protect the roads by charging, you know, what's appropriate based on the damage people do.
All right, we'll go to Ryan in Racine now. Ryan, hi.
Howdy. Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment that it sounds all common sense to me. I mean, we need jobs. The roads are the worst I've ever seen in my life in Racine here, and you know, I'm almost 40. They're really ridiculous. And it's just common sense that we need to do this, and if tolls, you know, the administration thinks tolls will get it done, then it should have been done yesterday.
Ryan, thanks a lot for the call. Robert, you know, we said earlier we were talking about a gut reaction against toll roads in Wisconsin.
Yes.
Do you see public opinion becoming more favorable as we've heard from a couple callers?
It's starting to change. I mean, I expected almost everybody to say no or hell no, but there's actually survey research over the last decade that shows if you give people the option of say, all right, we need to spend X billion dollars on improving our roads, here's your choices. A big increase in the gasoline tax, some kind of a new sales tax, property tax, or tolls only for the roads that actually need to be improved. People, the top choice in that set is tolls on the roads that need to be improved, because people figure out that if they agree to any kind of an overall tax increase, they're going to pay, and they're not sure they're going to get anything from it. But if the toll only goes on roads that are improved, then they'll only pay if they get something worthwhile in exchange by, you know, for a road that they use that will be better. So I mean, there's still a lot of opposition. It's a gut level opposition. But a lot of people also don't realize that electronic tolling is coming fast, and there's not going to be toll plazas with long lines and delays and having to fumble for change and all that stuff. That's history. That's gone.
Let's get to another caller here. Robert joins us in La Crosse. Hi, Robert.
Hi, I just wanted to say that I'm opposed to paying for the roads and the highways through tolls. My greatest concern is that our dependence on the internal combustion engine, that gas taxes, if they're raised, would continue to encourage fuel efficiency, encourage commuting, you know, carpools, encourage rapid transit use, you know, encourage electric cars. And that the real problem is climate change and not the wear and tear on our roads. Mm. So to accomplish real reform, we need to move away from gasoline altogether. So charging fuel taxes will continue, you know, to pay for roads.
Uh-huh. Gotcha. That's an interesting perspective. What do you say to that, Robert?
Well, the data show that when people are faced with much higher prices of gasoline, including the tax, they generally don't switch away from cars. They just buy a more fuel-efficient vehicle or an electric vehicle or a hybrid. And so a policy of a big increase in the gas tax is not a very – it's kind of a blunt instrument. It's not very fine-tuned for getting people away from gasoline. It just makes them more motivated to buy a different kind of vehicle, which is probably good. But we still have the problem of needing to fix the roads. So we need a sustainable funding source for the highways, and that's really why I think the per-mile toll is the best way.
Robert, in our last few moments, this is a proposal from the White House to make it easier for states to have toll roads. Do you think Congress is going to get on board with this?
I hope so, and I think there's a decent shot at them doing that. There's a lot of lobbying by state DOTs and governors the states are in desperate shape for transportation funding, and if Congress is not going to give them any kind of an increase, the least they can do is give them permission to try new things by removing obstacles like the ban on tolling.
Robert, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
That was Robert Poole with the Reason Foundation. You can keep the conversation going. Do you want Wisconsin to have toll roads? Answer that question over on the Central Time Facebook page. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at the inner workings of Congress with Paul Singer.
But first, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York just released a report indicating that household debt is on the increase. In fact, this would be the third consecutive quarterly increase.
As Americans dig themselves out of the aftermath of the Great Recession, they're apparently borrowing a little more, but not so keen to run up credit cards or commit to new mortgages.
To find out what this means for households and the economy, we have with us Amer Sufi. He's professor of finance at the University of Chicago School of Business and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. His new book is House of Debt, How They and You Caused the Great Recession and How We Can Prevent It from Happening Again. Amer, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, looking at this report, it gets a little confusing. Overall debt is up, but we consumers are a little reluctant. We're scaling back on our credit cards, things like new mortgages. I want to start with a big picture. When we're looking at household debt as an indicator, is a rise in debt good news or bad news?
Well, it can be either. It really depends on whether the rise in debt is driven by what we would call fundamental economic improvements, higher wages, higher income, higher earning power, basically. And if it's not, if debt is rising the most for people who actually don't have better income growth or better wage growth, then that's kind of not a great thing. That's not a very sustainable way of generating economic activity.
So we've seen this household debt go up a little bit for three quarters in a row. How do you read that? Is this a good increase in debt or a bad increase?
Well, it's driven mostly by two main factors, and that is student debt and auto debt. And in both circumstances, in my view, there are some worrying factors. For example, wage growth among college graduates continues to kind of be depressed, and the unemployment rate facing college graduates continues to be high. So it seems like people are optimistic going into school, willing to take on more debt, yet the actual wages they're going to earn, the wages they're going to need to earn in order to pay back that debt, is still pretty, that wage growth is still pretty low. And so you do worry that student debt, with this rising burden of it, is going to continue to kind of depress economic activity among younger Americans. We're talking home buying, spending. That's the kind of worry I think a lot of people have when they're looking at this rising student debt number. On the auto side, what's interesting is a lot of the auto debt is also being driven by extension of credit to what I would call more marginal borrowers, people with low credit scores, subprime borrowers. In fact, subprime auto loan issuance has increased substantially. And again, I would point out, do we really think wage growth is actually improving among these low credit score, low income individuals? And if not, then again, we worry that eventually they won't be able to pay back this debt. And so it's kind of a short-term boost to economic activity, but it might not be viable in the long run.
So what we'd like to see for economic growth and recovery is people thinking, I've got a better job, I'm more confident that I'm going to keep my job in the future, therefore I'm willing to take out this loan for a car or a home or something. You're worried that with student loans and auto loans in particular, we're not seeing that. We're seeing people maybe being overextended.
That's right. I mean, I don't want to sound the fire alarm, but it does look to me like we are not yet seeing the kind of improvement in the job market, in wages, that would sustain higher levels of debt. The rise in debt over the last three quarters, as you mentioned, it has increased. Now, it hasn't increased substantially. And in fact, the pattern that worries me more is not so much the aggregate increase in household debt, but it is kind of when I look at the micro data and I look at the fact that, especially in the auto loan space, you do see a lot more subprime auto loan issuance. And so you worry, well, what's eventually going to happen when people might not be able to pay back that debt? That obviously means more defaults in that space, but it also means potentially we won't see as many new car sales, which are an important part driving economic growth currently.
Now, when subprime became a household word and maybe a dirty word, it had to do mostly with mortgages. What are we seeing there as far as people's willingness to take on mortgage debt?
Well, that's what's interesting. And the mortgage market seems to be the one anomaly in current loan markets. Even credit card debt issuance, as you mentioned, it has gone down overall. But credit card originations, just people getting a new credit card, whether they're spending on it or not, has been going up for lower credit score individuals as well. So auto loans and credit card loans has been going up for subprime individuals. But mortgage debt continues to be a spot where there's extremely high credit scores among the people who actually are able to successfully get a mortgage. So it seems like lenders, in some sense, got burned so bad that they're not returning to that space. And so that space is basically still dead. There's basically almost no credit issuance to very low credit score individuals in the mortgage space. It seems instead that lenders have moved to the auto and credit card space in order to kind of extend credit to these low credit score individuals.
So that's coming from the banker's side in the mortgages. It's a matter of bankers saying, we don't want to make risky loans, not people maybe on the margins saying, I can't afford this mortgage right now.
Right. And that's one of the things our research shows pretty definitively and our book, and that is there is a substantial segment of the U.S. population that essentially will borrow if they're given the opportunity to borrow. And that's something that's a bit worrisome. So even if they don't have wage growth, even if they don't have income growth, oftentimes if a creditor is willing to extend them credit, even if they can't handle that increased debt burden, they sometimes will take it. So that's something that you do see right now in the subprime auto space and the credit card space. But I would agree, it's not, in my opinion, people not wanting to get a mortgage because they don't feel like they can actually sustain one. Instead, it seems more coming from the other side, that they're not able to get a mortgage. A lender's not willing to extend them that credit.
Going to the topic of your book and the big picture here, I think a lot of people are looking at all this and saying it's fine as long as you don't go back to what happened in 2008. Have we as individuals, have lending institutions, the government for that matter, learned lessons from 2008 to where we're going to avoid that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that it's unlikely that we're going to see the kind of rapid increase in household debt that we saw from 2000 to 2007. To be frank, that was an unprecedented rise in household debt that you'd have to go all the way back to prior to the Great Depression to see that kind of rise in household debt. Although I will say one of the things that we're trying to push in this book is just the notion that debt itself is a very dangerous instrument, even if it's not used in a huge amount of quantity, because of the way it distributes the losses from an economic crash. And that is, the indebted, who tend to be poorer individuals, lower net worth individuals, they basically take the first hit when they have a lot of debt. And that's something that we argue we need to kind of rethink the financial system in order to get rid of such harsh debt contracts that impose these losses on the people who are least able to actually handle them.
So is the answer there making debt less accessible to people in that situation or making it more affordable and less risky?
It could be either. So, for example, there's been a big rise in people renting homes. Renting homes, in our view, is a good thing. It's basically saying to people, look, you might as well take whatever extra cash you have, maybe put it in assets like the stock market or bonds or even deposits in a bank. That, in some sense, is a less risky bet than sometimes putting it into a home with a mortgage, because the analysis we always give is, if you have a $100,000 home, if you have an $80,000 mortgage, so you have $20,000 of equity, if your home goes down $20,000, you take that loss. You lose 100% of your investment before the lender takes any loss at all. And that's the notion by which we mean debt is a very harsh instrument. And so we kind of advocate either people renting or having debt contracts that are more flexible. Suppose you have a debt contract where the principal balance actually went down if house prices fell in your neighborhood. Those are the kinds of ideas we basically talk about in the book.
As we wrap up for now, this is one indicator among many, this report from the Federal Reserve of New York. What do you have your eyes on? What are you watching for next?
Well, I definitely look a lot at what's going on among the more marginal borrower population, people who basically are still very much struggling in the aftermath of the Great Recession, still seeing very low wage growth. This is related, of course, to the increase in inequality that we've seen over the past couple of decades. And I'm watching this segment of the population to see, are they getting better wages? Are they better getting better income? Or are they fueling aggregate spending by just levering up again, getting an auto loan, getting a credit card loan? If it's the latter, if they're just getting more debt to fuel economic activity, then that kind of gives me a worried feeling about the future of the economy, that it might not be as robust as we might even think it is, even though most people think it's pretty weak already.
Amer, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
That was Amer Soufi, professor of finance at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. He's the co-author of the new book, House of Debt. It's time for a weekly roundup of what's going on in Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. Since the 2012 terrorist attack on the U.S. mission in Benghazi, Republicans have been accusing the White House of covering things up. They've voted to set up a new panel to continue the investigation.
And Democrats may be at odds with the president. They're blocking one of his judicial nominees and have taken up a set of corporate tax breaks in the Senate that the president has threatened to veto. As always, there's a lot of news from the road to this fall's midterm elections, too, that we can look at. Paul Singer joins us every week at this time to share the goods from Washington. Happy Wednesday, Paul.
Happy Wednesday to you, Veronica. How are you doing?
Doing okay. Well, the House voted to create a panel to investigate the 2012 terrorist attack on the U.S. mission in Benghazi. Now, this is not the first probe into the events that happened. What exactly is the game plan here for Republicans in the House?
That is a very good question. And it is not clear they have a very good answer. In fact, the Democrats at this point have not said whether they're going to participate in this thing because they're not sure what the game plan is either. There's a bunch going on here. As you mentioned, there have already been several probes by other House committees run by Republicans into what happened September 11th, 2012 in Benghazi. It's a very complex picture, in part because ultimately this is an attack on a CIA annex to a diplomatic building, and the CIA doesn't want to talk about what they were doing there. So you're into a lot of sensitive information. And these probes have already been going on, and so now why do you launch a new one? It seems clear the Republicans don't want this just to be a rehash of old allegations that doesn't get anywhere. And it also seems sort of clear they would like to centralize this discussion so it's not going on five different places at once. What is not clear is whether they're going to try and, you know, subpoena former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, whether they're going to try and force testimony from current Secretary of State John Kerry, who, of course, was not Secretary of State at the time, whether they're going to focus on talking points that the White House was kicking around in the immediate aftermath of the attacks for how they would speak about it on television. That is the part that has been the most aggressive line of attack by Republicans the past few weeks, but it's the one that in some ways means the least, because it's really just about what did you say on TV, not about what did you do to protect Americans on the ground.
Right, so there's a lot that we don't know about how things are going to proceed. Do you have any sense of what they're looking for, per se, that they haven't been able to get at so far?
No. In fact, there was an interesting article a couple of days ago that we had where we had sort of probed into what they were looking for on the commission, and there was a quote from a Democrat who said, look, you know, there's no unanswered questions here. It's been pretty clear that, you know, what happened there. It's been pretty clear that it was a terrorist attack planned by an Al-Qaeda offshoot on a base that was a CIA mission, that there was a dispute between the State Department and the CIA over who's supposed to be protecting it. there's not a lot of unanswered questions. And the chairman of the committee, Trey Gowdy, responded that there's still unanswered questions about the talking points of what the administration said immediately thereafter, sort of immediately diverging back to this sort of conversation about, was the administration trying to hide the fact this is a terrorist attack just before the elections of 2012? So I don't know. I mean, I honestly can't tell you exactly what questions they're going to pursue and whether there is terrain. Because keep in mind, if they conclude there's a lot of unanswered questions about the military response and about the security of the facility, they are concluding that their own investigations didn't answer the questions, which is also not a good thing for the Republicans.
Well, but then you've got Democrats who are saying that this is just being dragged out because it could be of some use to Republicans in the midterm elections and could possibly be damaging to Hillary Clinton, who's emerging as a strong candidate for 2016. How do you see it from where you stand?
Well, it is impossible to look at this without recognizing that there is a large Hillary Clinton element, that a significant portion of this is spawned from doubts that Republicans have about Hillary Clinton's veracity. And they see her as somebody who is fundamentally not telling the truth. And, of course, they care about her still, despite the fact she's no longer in office, because she could be a 2016 presidential candidate. I don't think that's an unfair allegation to make, that these guys are partly interested in this because it's a Hillary Clinton issue. But they also, I mean, I think in fairness to them, they remember a lot of Republicans don't believe that the Obama administration has been very forthright on a bunch of things, and they think this is an issue where they can prove the Obama administration has not been forthright, and it's a good issue to stick to for them because there's plenty of, you know, territory there to make this point that we don't trust Obama.
And real quick before we move on, because there's a lot to talk about, is there evidence that Americans, should Hillary Clinton come out, you know, looking less than idealist, that they're going to care, that voters are going to care about this, and it's enough to give her to take a hit in 2016?
You know, who knows? I mean, a presidential campaign is long. There are 1,000 hits between here and there. Who knows which ones stick? My impression is that Benghazi is a really good way to fire up the base. I am not convinced and have not seen polling or any evidence that it is a broad attack. It's the sort of thing that would broadly sour people on Hillary Clinton if they were otherwise inclined to vote for her.
Well, and yesterday, the Democratic-controlled Senate took up a set of tax breaks for businesses, tax breaks that would increase the deficit. Now, this, as you know, after a long time where Congress was sort of in alarm mode about anything that would raise the deficit. So
yeah.
What's going on here? Is the Senate just not that into lowering the deficit anymore? And are we into a new phase?
They're just not that into you anymore. Yeah. Well, you know, the deficit's getting smaller. The deficit has been shrinking. The economy has been getting a little bit better. And so to some degree, the panic is off. The other thing is that, you know, I don't know that I've ever seen a temporary tax break. Once you create these temporary tax breaks, it's hard to have them go away. And what this bill would do is extend a whole bunch of existing tax breaks for everything from research and development to, you name it, the little tax breaks that's out there, you know, for small businesses and other things. And it's billions of dollars. I'm trying to remember what the number is, but it's a lot. It's like $150 billion over 10 years. And the administration has been very interesting on this point. What they've said is, we don't want to do this unless we can figure out some way to offset the revenue. Oh, and by the way, we think you should be extending the unemployment tax break or the unemployment insurance, and we have figured out ways to finesse the numbers on that thing. So maybe there's a point here where we can finesse some of the numbers on these things, and it won't really count as an offset, and now you get into the weeds of how Congress budgets for stuff. The administration has not said, we're going to veto this bill. But the administration, you know, wants to be clear that they don't want to just give away the store again for no reason. You know, my hunch is it's an election year. These are tax credits that already exist in law. It's hard to repeal them or let them die, particularly when you've got a bunch of moderate Democrats trying to win re-elections and Senate seats.
Okay, in our last minute here, we've got a story from West Virginia. West Virginia poised to make history. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, they got two women running for the Senate against each other, and they will have a woman senator. I think it's the first woman senator West Virginia will ever had, replacing Senator Rockefeller, who's been there for several decades. And the two candidates, Congresswoman Capito and Tennant, who is the Attorney General now, I believe, two women will be facing off. It's not often we see a woman versus woman Senate race. But they're becoming more common in America as more women are getting involved in politics. And we will have a woman senator from West Virginia one way or the other. And that's kind of a cool thing.
Yeah, an interesting story there. Apparently, they're only the 13th state to have two women in for going for the upper office there.
Yeah, but you'll see that more of those races have been in the past few years. Like it was a long time before it ever happened, and in the past 5 or 6 years, you've seen several of them. So I think you'll see more of it. And we've written and on this show we've talked about the fact that, you know, women in the Senate are becoming a force, and in some cases a force for a more productive, more moderate Senate.
Looking at a trend. Well, Paul, thank you so much for joining us as always.
My pleasure. Talk to you next week.
That was Paul Singer, politics editor for USA Today. He joins us every Wednesday at this time to share the week's news from Congress.